Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
126,000. That's the measly number of jobs the economy added last month. We'll take a closer look, and because no one's working in the stock markets today, we'll play some billiards and do a little gambling. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdal. It's Friday, the 3rd of April. Great to have you with us. The recovery in the job market slowed way down last month, according to the Labor Department. That 126,000 new jobs in March was the weakest growth in more than a year. The unemployment rate, meanwhile, stayed flat at 5.5%. Joining us now to make sense of the numbers and the week that was are Cardiff Garcia of FT Alphaville and Lynette Lopez of Business Insider. Hi, guys.
Hi, Amy.
Hey, how's it going, Amy?
So we're going to hear more about the kinds of jobs that were lost a little later on in the show. But Lynette, how seriously should we take this one report today?
Listen, these things happen. Every now and then we're going to get a bad report. One thing that I'm super optimistic about, and it's something that I talk about on the show every single time I'm on the show, and it's that we did see a little bit of wage growth in this report. And it's, to me, the really most important part of the jobs report, and that was positive. So I'm still hanging on here. I think that, you know, the oil and gas prices, that's starting to affect the economy. We're starting to see jobs lost there. And so, you know,
But Cardiff, economists were expecting a lot more jobs. I mean, why the big miss?
Well, it's hard to say, and it seems like we find ourselves in the same position almost every single year where we have a strong finish to the year and then all of a sudden things slow down a bit in the first quarter. So I think Lynette makes a good point, though, which is that there are some signs that this is maybe just a blip, maybe just an aberration. The weather was bad yet again in the first quarter.
Oh, really?
You have a lot of people saving more money than they had in the past, possibly because they're not sure if the savings they've gained from lower gas prices are going to stick around. That could change as well. It's hard to say. But anytime you're still in a situation where so many people have part-time jobs but would rather have full-time jobs, you still have a long-term unemployment problem, it's worth being concerned, especially since essentially this report confirmed a lot of other economic indicators that were also pretty bad in the first quarter. So it's unclear what's going to happen next, but this isn't a great thing. I hope everybody's paying attention and not being complacent about it.
And yeah, so next question, of course, is what does this mean for what the Fed will do about interest rates, Lynette?
Well, we shall see. I mean, Janet Yellen has been very clear. She's going to wait. She's going to look for wage growth. We still have that despite this crappy jobs number. So perhaps the plan is full steam ahead. But we'll see what she says the next time that she's in public and letting us know what the Fed is thinking.
Cardiff, you agree there?
Yeah, I do. I don't think that this would be enough to have her change her mind, but I also didn't think that June was a good date for them to raise rates anyways.
Oh,
I think they
agreed.
Were thinking already later on. And so if you look at some of the commentary by not just Janet Yellen, but some of the other Fed members, they thought that the first quarter might come in a little weaker than expected anyway. So my guess is they'll wait for the next couple of reports to see if this is a meaningful trend or just another blip.
So, of course, another big story this week was the framework of a nuclear deal that was agreed to with Iran. So what happens now with economic sanctions? How soon do we see those start to be lifted, Lynette?
Well, we won't know until June when there's actually a deal. So until then, I do know that businesses are already starting to talk to each other in terms of, like, big businesses, like auto companies. But again, until the deal is finalized, we're not really going to know. It is a huge opportunity, though, if that market opens up.
Yeah, and we'll have more on the impact on oil prices later. But, you know, what does this mean for the Iranian economy, which has been just crippled by these sanctions?
Well, I mean, I think it would help quite a bit. Certainly Iran and maybe some of their business partners will benefit from it. The overall global economic impact, the direct economic impact, would probably be pretty small. But the indirect impact, if this contributes to larger geopolitical stability and certainly through the oil markets, that actually could be big. But it would take some time for that to show up. So I think we're going to have to be patient to see what kind of an economic impact this is going to have.
All right. So who you guys have for the final four?
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, what? What's going on?
Next question.
All right, we're not bettors.
Not two sports fans here that don't follow basketball.
Can we cut to commercial?
Tom Izzo's team, maybe? You know, who knows?
All right, Cardiff Garcia, Lynette Lopez, thank you guys so much for joining us.
Thanks, Amy. All right. Appreciate it.
Bye.
On Wall Street, not much was open on this Good Friday, but we'll still have something to tell you when we do the numbers. The standout weak spot in the jobs report was mining, specifically oil and gas extraction. Employers related to that industry dumped 11,000 jobs last month. Given the big drop in oil prices over the past few months, that's really no surprise. When oil prices are low, companies do less drilling. And in a place like North Dakota, also less fracking. That's the process used there to get the oil out of the ground. The upshot in North Dakota is simply less work on the oil fields. Marketplace's Annie Baxter spent some time there recently and has this report.
Mike Wallizer is only 28, but has the weariness of a much older guy.
Right now, it feels like the balloon's been deflated.
Wallizer runs a company that provides all sorts of equipment and services to the oil industry in North Dakota, including cranes. He recently showed up at a networking event looking for new business partners. His revenue tied to the oil field is way down.
We think that we'll probably come in at half this year at this point, so of what we did last year.
Wallizer says he's down about 25 positions, mostly through attrition so far, but harsher layoffs could come this summer. Some other companies have already made big cuts, or in many cases, they've slashed workers' hours and wages.
Between the salary and the bonus scale, it was so far down that it was getting too expensive to live out there.
Brandon Hartman says he used to pull in more than $100,000 a year on a fracking crew in North Dakota. He says his income recently fell by half, but rent didn't. He quit his job at the end of February and left the oil field, taking his wife and kids back to their native Minnesota.
I don't even take it anymore. I was so stressed out about, was I going to be able to make anything next week, or was I even going to have a job?
Companies are drilling and fracking far fewer new wells. Why bother when oil prices are so low? But existing wells still need to be kept up. That's good news for some workers, like Chad Perot and his buddies, who repair wells. At a bar in the oil patch, Perot says oil will have to drop a lot more before he loses work.
Our job is pretty secure for the time being, but unless it's a total bust.
Perot says he is keeping a watchful eye on oil prices to see if things change. In Williston, North Dakota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
You may never look at a simple Oreo cookie in quite the same way after this next story. Regulators at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission have accused Kraft Foods and Mondelez International of speculating on and manipulating the price of wheat, which is, of course, a major ingredient in cookies and crackers. Stan Alcorn explains what exactly the companies are accused of doing.
Every year in Toledo, Ohio, tens of millions of bushels of soft red winter wheat are ground into flour to go into Oreos, Chips Ahoy, and all kinds of crackers. So if the price of that wheat goes up a dollar, it costs the snack makers tens of millions. Jack Scoville is a wheat broker.
They're a big player, let's face it. You know, there's a lot of Ritz's bought every day.
To avoid suddenly expensive Ritz crackers, Kraft and Mondelez lock in wheat prices with futures contracts. So a few months down the line, whether wheat went up or down, they can pay the same amount.
That's the benefit of hedging. You know, yes, you give away that chance for the whirlwind profit, but that's not what they're really after.
But the CFTC says that in 2011, Kraft and Mondelez did go after extra profit by buying way more wheat futures than they needed.
Reading the allegations in the complaint, it looks like a traditional, you know, corner or squeeze.
By squeeze, finance professor Craig Perrong means buying so much they single-handedly pushed up the price to sell the extra wheat futures for a profit. But profit alone doesn't make manipulation, according to former CFTC lawyer Jerry Markham.
Manipulation means that you're taking some action with the intent to create an artificial price.
And how do you prove it's an artificial price?
When you get that answer, let me know. We've been searching for that for years.
The companies didn't comment because of the active litigation, which Markham doesn't expect to be resolved for a few more years. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
The international ivory trade was banned more than 20 years ago, but poachers still kill an estimated 40,000 elephants every year for their tusks. Our next story goes back to a time when the legitimate ivory trade was booming, 150 years ago, when the quest for a cheaper way to make one high-end ivory product led, in a sense, to a whole new industrial era. That product was billiard balls. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Dan Weissman has the story.
You could almost call Michael Phelan the Steve Jobs of billiards.
I think that's an understatement.
That's Michael Chamos. He's the author of the Illustrated Encyclopedia of Billiards.
While Steve Jobs did amazingly brilliant things, he was not fully responsible for the computer. But Phelan, in many ways, was responsible for the uptake of billiards in the United States.
And billiards was the most popular amusement for men in the second half of the 19th century. Phelan was the top player, a best-selling author, and the first big manufacturer of billiards tables. And to popularize the game, he helped standardize the gear. And here's the thing. You standardize a billiard ball, it's a high standard.
The billiard ball has to have certain physical properties. It has to rebound properly. It has to be of uniform density.
And in the 19th century, that meant ivory, which was not cheap. And for billiard balls, only the best ivory would do, the top grade. And
the average number of billiard balls that could be obtained from a single tusk was 3.
So, billiard balls, very expensive. And when you're trying to build an industry, that's a problem.
The entire trade depended on the shortage of this one exotic material.
That's Robert Friedel. He's a professor at the University of Maryland. He studies the history of technology, and he wrote the book on what happens next. So it's like if the Apple Watch could only be sold in the $10,000 gold edition, because gold was necessary to make the thing work. Phelan takes out an ad in the paper, and here's a dramatization of what happened when a printer named John Wesley Hyatt found that ad. It's from an old radio show called Cavalcade of America, a 1937 episode called, spoiler alert, John Wesley Hyatt, Father of Plastics.
A prize of $10,000 for the discovery of a satisfactory substitute for ivory in making billiard balls. Say, that's a lot of money.
Hyatt experiments with a newly discovered material, nitrated cellulose, cotton fiber treated with nitric and sulfuric acid.
And that material turned out to have very interesting properties. And in particular, it dissolved and it creates a very syrupy liquid.
Printers used it to protect their hands. And in the radio version, Hyatt gets his key inspiration when a bottle of the stuff overturns and he watches it dry into a film that he finds interesting.
Why, this bit of film has given me an idea. And the idea, Tommy, might be worth $10,000.
It's not, at least not right away. Hyatt does produce the first plastic called celluloid, but it does not win Phelan's prize.
Celluloid is a wonderful material. It's a beautiful plastic. It has a wonderful range of uses, but billiard balls is not one of them.
Balls made with celluloid, they just don't bounce right. Hyatt looks for another market and finds the perfect thing. Fake ivory for knickknacks. Knife handles, combs, hand mirrors.
Even toys and boxes, a gigantic range of things.
Also, piano keys. billiard balls kept getting made out of ivory, which was okay for the billiards industry anyway, because Europeans kept colonizing and exploiting more of Africa. It was not great for the people of Africa, and it was terrible for elephants. And by 1910, the elephant population had dropped to the point where billiard ball makers, among others, were getting acutely worried about the ivory supply. That's right about when a chemist named Leo Bakelin comes up with a new kind of plastic made from petroleum. He names it Bakelite after himself. And one cool thing about Bakelite, you can melt it and mix in fillers.
With that capability, you can vary the density, you can vary the elasticity, and you can make a perfect billiard ball.
Celluloid gets supplanted by newer plastics, except for one key use. One thing where celluloid, they say, performs better than any other material. Ping pong balls. Celluloid balls got bumped from tournament play just last year, and it was controversial. But that's another story. For now, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
At the end of the day, you are going to be judged by what you've learned, what you can do, and there are many, many paths to where you want to go.
Why, it might not matter which college you go to. But first, let's do the numbers. Major stock exchanges were closed in the U.S. and Europe for Good Friday, but the bond market had a short session, and it was dramatic. Prices rose sharply. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.84%, its lowest level in almost 2 months. And now, because we can't bring you our usual market basket, how about some numbers on the Easter basket? There will be more than 90 million chocolate bunnies in the mix. More than 700 million marshmallow peeps were produced for the holiday alone. Good thing production time has dropped from 27 minutes per peep in 1953 to just 6 minutes today. Passover also starts tonight, and that means matzah and gefilte fish in Israel. Household spending goes up 10% during Passover. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the First Family will host the annual White House Easter Egg Roll. On Wall Street, stock markets will reopen after a three-day weekend. And attention, my fellow baseball fanatics. Happiness and fulfillment abounds as teams set to open the 2015 MLB season over the weekend. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. News of progress on a nuclear agreement with Iran pushed oil prices down nearly 4% yesterday. Iran used to be a big exporter of oil, and the lifting of sanctions could have a significant impact on a market already awash in cheap crude. The business climate in the Middle East is anything but stable right now, though, so it may be a long time before any Iranian oil reaches the world market. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
On its face, a deal with Iran should push the global price of oil and gas down even farther than it already is, which would be bad news for U.S. shale producers. But Kate Durian with the Middle East Economic Survey says barriers remain before Iran can reemerge as a viable oil-exporting country.
The timing is off. It's going to be very difficult for Iran to come back to the market because they've lost market share, they've lost customers. So I think it's not going to be a smooth ride for them.
In order to get production back up, Iran needs an infusion of technology and investment from outside companies, which is a gamble many firms aren't willing to take.
It's got to be a really good deal for them to go in, and I don't think they're going to go rushing in, because if they don't comply, the sanctions can come right back in again.
All else being equal, 3 to 5 years from now, if Iran lives up to its end of the bargain, Iranian exports could push oil prices down. But Trevor Hauser of the Rhodium Group says he's not banking on things being equal.
The oil market's a volatile beast. The world remains a dangerous place. I won't bet on oil remaining permanently cheap just because of the deal yesterday.
Hauser says any number of potential market disruptions could account for the 1.5 million barrels per day that Iran could supply.
That's about how much production we lost in Libya. It's how much production you could lose from a significant disruption in Nigeria or Venezuela.
Even without outside investment, Hauser says Iran could start exporting some of its current stockpiles by early 2016. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
On a day the stock markets were closed, how about a look at a different kind of speculation, specifically betting on the NCAA men's basketball tournament? You may already be aware that the Final Four starts tomorrow. The big favorite is the Kentucky Wildcats. Many people bet for them to win the tournament. Some bet long ago for them to finish the season undefeated, which would be a first in men's college basketball in almost 40 years. That means the bookmakers who took those bets are rooting against the Wildcats. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
And Indiana is the national champion.
It was a big victory for Indiana, going undefeated back in 1976. Kentucky pulls off a repeat this year, and the cheering will come from anybody who picked them for their bracket, and also some lucky bettors who wagered with the Vegas sportsbook company William Hill.
We were contacted by a University of Kentucky fan. Can you put up a prop? Will Kentucky go undefeated this year?
That's Michael Grodsky at William Hill, and to explain, a prop is a kind of bet. Will X happen or not? They first offered the bet last season. Kentucky got beat. The firm did well. This year, they offered it starting at 50-1. With two games left, Grodsky's getting a little nervous.
The biggest liability of a prop we've had, it's a mid-six-figure decision for us. So we kind of have a mantra around the office right now, anyone but Kentucky.
Though Grodsky says it's not going to break the bank if Kentucky pulls it out. Now, some of us bet on basketball teams we love. Some bet on stocks and tech startups.
We pick the winners based on our emotional like of the people we're investing in, very similar to gambling on sports.
That's Vivek Wadhwa, serial entrepreneur and fellow at Stanford Law School.
You think you have all these formulas, you think you have all these data, and you take the risk. The difference over here is venture capitalists played with someone else's money.
And Wadhwa says, just like college sports, there's a home team everyone roots for, any startup that comes out of Stanford. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
It is college acceptance season, or more accurately, rejection season when it comes to the most elite schools. There was news in the past week that Harvard and Stanford turned away about 95% of applicants this year, a new record for Harvard. There are lots of reasons top-ranked colleges are turning away more applicants. For one, they're getting more because of more aggressive recruiting. And because some kids are so unsure of what it will take to get in, they're applying everywhere. All of this can be crazy-making and heartbreaking for a lot of kids and their parents. New York Times op-ed columnist Frank Bruni says it doesn't have to be. He's out with a new book, Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be. Great to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We should point out, of course, that this mania that you describe and this obsession with name brands is really limited to a pretty small crop of students aiming for elite colleges. But where did this fixation on getting into a top school come from?
Well, it's been with us for a long time. It's just gotten much more intense lately. It's fed by a whole industry, you know, of admissions consultants and coaches. I think it's informed by the economic pessimism of the country. You know, it used to be when you asked Americans, will your kids do better than I will? They would say yes. Now that answer, most Americans don't believe their kids will do better. I think in their anxiety about the country's prosperity and its future, they want to give kids any leg up, anything that might be a leg up, and they see elite schools as one of those things.
And how do these elite schools feed the frenzy? I mean, several big-name schools even extended their application deadlines this year, only, it seems, in order to reject more students and you know, look more selective.
Well, you know, they've all transferred to the Common App, which is an electronic form that allows you to apply to many, many schools and only kind of do a little bit of supplemental work for each individual school. So they feed it by making it easy to apply. As you said, some of them have extended deadlines. They market themselves to students like never before. They want to get the best students, and they want the most diverse student body, so that's the good impulse behind it. But they also just want big, big numbers, because we've entered an era here where a low acceptance rate, proof that you have turned away masses of people, is bragging rights among colleges. And so when Stanford last year posted the first ever 5% acceptance rate, you know there was a shudder at Harvard and Yale and Princeton and a feeling like, we better get our applications up.
And in fact, this year, Harvard is almost down to 5% acceptance.
Harvard hit a new low. Columbia hit a new low. I mean, it's really crazy. But we're going to look up in 5 years and someone's going to say, hey, we did negative integers, a negative 1% acceptance rate.
I want to take apart this idea that where you go doesn't matter. For low-income students, there is research that says that going to a selective school can make a big difference, not only in whether they graduate, but also how much they might earn later in life. So, you know, is it really fair to say that the brand doesn't buy a lot of opportunities?
No, it's not fair to say the brand doesn't buy opportunities, and you've noted an important asterisk. You're absolutely right about the research. But here's the thing. We're giving, the reason the anxiety is at the level it is right now is because we're giving families the message that it's going to matter in an enormous, profound, and irrevocable way. What I'm saying in the book and my message is, yes, an elite school with a low acceptance rate can give you an advantage, certainly right at the beginning. But it's not a do-or-die, make-or-break advantage. It's not going to last your whole life. At the end of the day, you are going to be judged by what you've learned, what you can do, and there are many, many paths to where you want to go.
Frank Bruni writes an op-ed column for the New York Times. The book is Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
This final note, we still have a ways to go before the 2015 football season kicks off, but a reporter from the Baltimore Sun broke some big news about the NFL today. Seems the league has appointed its first ever female permanent game official. Sarah Thomas is her name, and she's no stranger to breaking new ground when it comes to football. She was the first woman to officiate a major college game in 2007. 2 years later, she was the first woman to officiate a bowl game. The season starts officially on September 10th.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
All right, that's it. That's Marketplace for the day. The stock markets were closed for the Good Friday holiday. They'll reopen next week. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. Tommy Andres is acting senior producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Amy Scott. Kai Ryssdal will be back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.